Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.
I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
Today, as Americans celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, we ask if Dr. King's dream has been realized. What civil rights and racial justice progress has been made? And have we regressed in some ways? Joining us today is Chad Dion Lassiter. He's the executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission and a recognized national race relations expert. Mr. Lassiter, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. Amanda Kemp. She's a visiting scholar of Africana Studies at Franklin and Marshall College. She's an author and racial justice and mindfulness mentor. Dr. Kemp, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Amanda Kemp, let me start with you and just ask the question of what we heard from Dr. King's most famous speech. Has that dream been realized?
Well, I have to say that I wouldn't be here without that dream, without that movement. I grew up in poverty. I grew up in foster care. I grew up with a mom who's addicted to heroin. And it was special programs created, anti-poverty programs. It was mentoring programs, educational programs that came up in the late 60s and 70s that helped kids like me. I grew up in the South Bronx. So on the one hand, yes, the work, the labor, the incredible, mighty labor and intellectual, emotional, spiritual labor that those folks put forward absolutely had a powerful impact. And at the same time, the work is clearly incomplete. We clearly have racial disparities in almost every area of life. And so what I want us to take from Dr. King's life and the movement and all those people who sacrificed and gave to us is that we have to carry it on. And we have to carry it on in the spirit of love and incredible desire for justice. Never let the two separate, love and justice, compassion and a sense of never giving up, never surrendering.
So let me ask the same question of you, Chad Dion Lassiter. Dr. King's dream, how do you see it today?
I think aspects of Dr. King's dream has been fulfilled. What I do is I situate the moment that we find ourselves in, and I think about what King would be looking at. And King would still be looking at the various things that he looked about when he was talking about the triple evils. He talked about the evils of poverty, the evils of racism, and the evils of war. And more specifically, he was talking about the military-industrial complex. And so I guess a question for me emerges is, how do we enable people who live on the outskirts of hope to come back into the circle of opportunity? King oftentimes talked about the beloved community. And what we find ourselves in this emboldened era is we see that there still is a fight for civil rights, a fight for voting rights, and a fight for a fair economy. And so I would agree with Dr. Kemp in the sense that none of us would be here, people of color and just people of goodwill, had not King joined with our Jewish brothers and sisters and multiple others during the civil rights movement to bring about legislation that spoke back to the Jim and Jane Crow policies of institutional racism, which is power plus privilege. And so the challenge for us is to not look at King from a standpoint of the moment, but look at the movement that led to bringing in change and continue the work like Marion Wright Elderman and many others have done.
I want to, and I'll ask you, Chad Dion Lassiter, first. It seems as though, okay, yes, we made a lot of progress over, say, 40 years or so when it comes to race relations, civil rights, maybe reducing that gap in poverty. But the last 10 years or so, in particular, it seems as though there has been some regression. that things have changed. I mean, we're nowhere near what we were like in 1967, 1968. But at the same time, maybe some things are, but that we have regressed in some ways. Do you see it that way?
Oh, we certainly have regressed. And I think, once again, we have to put King in context. When we look at the I Have a Dream speech, we get to the part that was just played. But prior to that, King talked about the wells of democracy. He talked about a check marked insufficient funds. He was talking about the promise of 40 acres and a mule after Reconstruction. He was talking about, you know, standing on an island solely by oneself, living and languishing in poverty. And so when we look at the impact of mass incarceration, when we look at two types of people in our democracy, the elites and we the people, when we look at educational apartheid, when we look at some of the gains that have been made under King and others, and we look at how the Supreme Court has shifted, a lot of those gains are being threatened at this very moment. And so we have regressed in a lot of ways, not just because of Donald Trump, but I think it would go back longer than just 10 years. I would say the last 30 years, we have seen a lot of things with regards to voter suppression and multiple other things being under attack.
Dr. Kemp, you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think when, you know, as a racial justice and mindfulness mentor, I help people on a one-on-one basis to really look at how they have internalized racism. And by that, I mean implicit racial bias, how they have by the narratives and images that we see in movies and music and commercials, magazines, etc., how those images where blackness is somehow denigrated or made invisible, what impact does that have on us? Because that impact then comes out in moments where there's like split second decisions to be made. And that's where you have the situation, for example, where when it comes down to it, when someone fears a black person and feels like they have to, you know, do something for their lives, when you look at disparities in terms of how we're treated in the criminal justice system, I think that implicit racial bias is definitely playing a role there. So, yes, there is the some of the advances that we've made. Yes, you could say we've lost some ground, but I also want to say there's been some places where we've gained some ground. So like in the era of Dr. King's work in the civil rights movement, the classic civil rights movement, there were a lot of people who were equating, well, if you're racist, you're bad. And if you're a good person, you can't be a racist, you know? So, but what we know about racism now is it's systemic. So it's not like whether or not you have an intention for it to exist. We look at racism now in terms of its what the results are. We're not just looking at what is intention. And the second piece is that what we understand now is that you can be a good person and have internalized attitudes and narratives and stereotypes without you even knowing it, simply because you've grown up in a society that is all around you, sort of drowning you in an ideology that places, you know, white Americans at the center or whiteness as better than other people of color, especially than black people. So what I've noticed in this moment is that there are more and more European Americans who are willing to see that and engage with that. And in the classic civil rights era, it was so stark in the sense of like, you know, the like Birmingham or Mississippi, where the racism was so overt that people were like, well, you can't be a good person and be a racist. So this you can see how this is getting more nuanced. And I think good people are seeing they have work to do, too.
You mentioned to me before we went on the air, I wanted to point this out, that 5 days. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So we're launching a 5-day Stop the Hurt challenge. And that challenge is focusing on implicit racial bias. So it starts today and it ends on Friday. It's free. All you have to do is you can go to my website, dramandakemp.com, and you'll see a link there. And each day we're taking a single action to stop implicit racial bias in ourselves. We can always point to others who need to do work, but I also think we need to look at ourselves. We have all grown up in this soup of, I'm going to call it white normativity, you can call it white supremacy, whatever works for you. But we've grown up in this soup of injustice. And so we've got to take steps ourselves.
Mr. Lassiter, let me ask you this question. You know, when we're talking about regressing over the past decade or so, and I'm just using decade, it may not be able to be, you know, that we could point at 2009 or anything. But when Barack Obama was elected president, the nation collectively, not everyone, but there were many people who patted themselves on the back saying, we're now in a post-racial era, that, see, America isn't as racist as it once was. We elected a black man president. But yet it seems as though that regression occurred during the Obama administration. Would you agree with that? And what happened?
Yeah, certainly. And I think one of the things is post-racial is still a mirage. We were so quick to want to say that we were post-racial without rolling up our sleeves and doing the work of making sure we dismantle institutional racism, white privilege, white supremacy, black victimization, all forms of economic justice, injustice, excuse me. And so Dr. Kemp is absolutely right. It's always convenient and advantageous for us to point to someone else. But when we have to do the deep dive and the self-introspection and put the mirror up to ourselves and look at what James Mills calls the racial contract and build allies, one of the things that we realize in the moment that we find ourselves is that we have more classes around white privilege and white studies on our college campuses, and there are curriculums that are looking at doing anti-racism training and not just diversity training. So we borrow from the work of a Jane Elliott. We borrow from the work of Tim Wise, and we borrow from the work of David Wellman and his work around portraits of white racism. And then there's an interesting human development aspect that I would like us to really focus on just as a democracy, and that's the work of Janet Helms, where she talks about white identity development, where whites oftentimes have a strong ethnic identity. You're from Russia, you're from a place in Europe, but don't have a strong racial identity. And the racial identity has to be rooted in not superiority, but it's okay to be white, but not from a standpoint of superiority. And so that work takes us through a progression that comes out, and we look at people like John Brown and those abolitionists, those white abolitionists who gave us the historical black colleges and universities. And so all of that for me is pretext and context. And solely stated, one of the challenges that we have is that we wanted to not do the hard work of having race dialogue and race conversations. And so we stated, hey, we have the first African-American president. There's no racism, institutional racism, all forms of inequality are going away with. And that wasn't true. It was post-racial is a mirage.
Why do you think that America has such an issue with discussing race relations and talking about this having this conversation honestly? Why does America have such an issue with this?
I think it's like a dysfunctional family, and I'm not the first person to say this. I want to give respect to Ricardo Levins Morales, a Puerto Rican. He said, we're like a dysfunctional family, and when you call out the sickness, then the rest of the family turns on you. So when you call out the incest or the abuse, you know, and you call out the dad, then everybody who's cooperated and somehow dealt with the sickness is when you call it out, it's like everybody has to readjust, and it's uncomfortable, and it's it means acknowledging pain and asking for forgiveness or asking for reparation or even acknowledging your own pain. So I want to say that for African Americans, I think that speak in broad terms. I think that European Americans think that African Americans are like, oh, we're so comfortable talking about race, we'll just do it in a minute, or, you know, kind of like that. We're so quick to call racism. And what I want to say is that we are living with historic, systemic, and ongoing trauma. And it is actually very difficult to acknowledge that trauma and how deep it goes, how generationally it's affected your family.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say that generational trauma is real. And there's some research out there that speaks to post-traumatic slave syndrome disorder, similar to PTSD. I would go a step further and just simply say that I think that the democracy has oftentimes been in denial. The conversations are very hard, but it becomes one of those things where the ruling class really profits from the colonialism, the imperialism, the white supremacy. And so to speak back to the oligarchs and the plutocrats really is a challenge, because one of the things that we want to continue to do is say, get over it. And we're not even talking about slavery. We're talking about injustices that exist now. We're talking about the anthology of police brutality, where some white cops and some black cops are killing black and brown bodies with impunity, unarmed. And so we're talking about the sentencing disparities of crack cocaine and powder cocaine. We're talking about the way we fund certain schools in urban areas as well as in rural areas. And so, once again, towards the tail end of his life, King was moving from civil rights to human rights. One of his greatest speeches was Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And so I think on this particular day, I Have a Dream speech is a great speech, but Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, and The Letter of a Birmingham Jail, I would just, you know, implore your listening audience to sit with those today, to
yes.
study those, to unpackage those, because they're really, really essential to the development of anyone that's trying to fight social justice on behalf of all humanity.
And also why we can't wait.
Yes.
I mean, you know, all of his books are really, mm-hmm. What I loved about the movie Selma was it really portrayed Dr. King as an activist, as an organizer. We like to think of him as a, quote, dreamer. And yes, we need visionaries, and he was visionary. But what we need to know is he was a human being who was actively trying to restructure our society, making choices, difficult ones, about where to focus, where to put his energy, and how to use that sense of urgency in a way that is healthy and balanced. What we know is that the transformation of America is not a sprint. It is not one presidential election. It is not, it's not a 4-year cycle. It is it's an ongoing work. And I think that what we need to do differently than we did, let's say, in the 1960s and 70s, is recognize that and know that we, the change makers, have to take care of ourselves. We have to direct our energy toward our own transformation as well as to the transformation of the collective.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, as we honor Dr. King and remember Dr. King's life and his accomplishments. We're talking about race relations in America. We're talking about justice, a lot of other topics, too, with Dr. Amanda Kemp, visiting scholar of Africana Studies at Franklin and Marshall College. She's an author, racial justice and mindfulness mentor, very talented. We actually have a poem that she set to music here in a few minutes that we'll let you hear a little bit of. Also, Chad Dion Lassiter, executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, and a national race relations expert as well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Michael in Lancaster. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to thank you all for your comments so far this morning. I've actually been trying to contemplate what I should reflect on for this holiday, and you gave me a lot of things to think about. But
that's what we're here for.
I wanted to call specifically because you were talking about the notion that simply because someone expresses racist behaviors, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad people. Just from context, I myself, I'm a Latino man. I'm a third-generation Puerto Rican, and I work in the church, and my people are good people. They're part of their community. They're loving. They donate, they feed the hungry, they clothe the naked, they try to live out that message, you know, I think everything that the Reverend King would want, but I have experienced moments where because they grew up in a community that is, if you look online, 90% white, and has been such for as long as it's existed, they say things slip out, you know, whether it be a reference to looking at black and brown bodies as the other and saying, referring to white bodies as normal and not realizing what that means, or even more recently explaining the journey of my own grandmother, who came as the first generation over from the island, and being a Puerto Rican woman, how she had to struggle through and earned all her degrees and her master's degrees and her PhD, and you know, what it meant for her to learn English and do all this, being a woman in her time,
so,
and a Puerto Rican woman at that. And the takeaway was that she endeavored to learn English. And I don't know what you would suggest in those moments where you're talking to someone that you're thinking, you're not a bad person, but maybe you don't understand. But personally, for myself, I've often found that first I should avoid attacking them. And then we'll start a small dialogue about, let's talk a little bit about how you phrase that. But I was wondering if and there's any input on how to handle those kinds of situations.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. Dr. Kemp, he brings up a point that I'm sure that whether it's Latinos, African Americans, the other, as he called it, that don't that aren't white, aren't European American, experience on a maybe not a daily basis, maybe so.
Yeah.
But how do you have that conversation?
Well, first of all, if you are a person of color, I ask you to take a breath. And just ask yourself, am I ready to have this conversation right now? Because if you're feeling hurt or overwhelmed or very angry, then I want you to take care of yourself first and then come back to that person to follow up on the conversation. If you're European American, I also want you to check in with yourself, but I want you to not give yourself a pass. I want you to say, take a breath, step forward, stay in your heart, and say, tell me more about that, and repeat that phrase that the person said to you. So, you know, tell me more about why you thought that so-and-so wasn't normal, or why, when you said that, it sounded like you were saying, you know, European Americans were normal, and so those who aren't normal. Just tell me more about that, and really give them a chance to explain themselves, say what they want. This is why you have to make sure that if you're a person of color, that you are grounded and you're ready to do this approach that I'm suggesting. And then I guess I suggest you listen to them, so that they felt listened to and not judged. And then you tell them what it's like for you to hear them say X, Y, or Z about your grandmother's story, or about, you know, when they call normal, meaning, and they mean white, what it felt like for you, or what it brought up for you. And I don't actually advocate that you lecture people or try to, like, you know, change their minds in a minute. But I do, I advocate that you plant seeds where you're in this one-on-one kind of situations with people. There's other situations where you have to hold people to account, and that is a different thing. That's a different kind of conversation. But to the minister, I also want to say, I think it's important when you work in predominantly white spaces, even though you have people of color in leadership, that you have to ongoingly educate and challenge your body, your church body or your organizational body, to look at their implicit racial bias. Because if you don't actively counter it, then you will by default perpetuate it.
I want to get into some of the disparities that do exist here in the United States today. One is the racial wealth gap between black and white households. Mr. Lassiter, why do you think that, I mean, obviously history has a whole lot to do with it, but in this day and age, why does it still happen? Why is it still a fact of life?
Well, I think it's a fact of life due to the systemic and structural racism that exists. We have a study out of Princeton University in which you had black males who had college degrees who applied for jobs and didn't get them, and the control group were white males who applied for the same jobs and had police records, and they still were hired. And so I think that we see that there is a divide, and it's the same divide that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was working on. I think also when we're looking at the whole aspect of taking care of ourselves, we need to also make sure that we discipline our spirits, that we discipline our tongue, that we discipline our actions in the same way that Dr. King and others did, which is through nonviolence. I think one of the other things, too, is for those of us like Dr. Kemp, myself, and multiple others who are doing this work, we have to take care of ourselves as well. Dr. King, at the age of 39, when he was assassinated, it was reported by the coroner that he had a heart of a 60-year-old, the stress that he was under, the generational trauma that his wife and his children experienced because of the horrific assassination of Dr. King. In that same era, he was 39 when he was killed. Medgar Evers was 39 when he was killed, and Malcolm X was 39 when he was killed. And so all these things are very important for us in this discussion about Dr. King, because Dr. King just wasn't by himself. He came out of a prophetic tradition with the black church. He came out of a family that spoke the language of social justice, a language of connecting us to one another. I think the other thing, too, is when we look at the wealth, we have to be able to push the conversation forward to fight for economic justice, because economic injustice exists, as we're talking about the most historical shutdown in government history. And so we see these challenges. We see the challenges of privilege versus the underclass. The middle class is almost being ameliorated. And so these are things that we have to continue to hold our elected officials accountable for. These are also things that we have to be able to step into these spaces and have these frank conversations. And maybe even some of us may have to run for political office to bring a form of truth philosophically to some of these body politics in this era of the widening divide from an economic standpoint.
Let me ask you this, though. I have to admit, and I'm just going to kind of, I don't know, confess to something here. I heard last fall President Trump say that the black unemployment rate was the lowest it ever been. Now, when I first heard that, I did a fact check, because I'll be honest with you, we know that a lot of times the president says things that can be misleading, can be untrue. So I did a fact check and found that it was true. And I thought to myself, why haven't we heard this? So, Mr. Lasseter, that is a fact in America that black unemployment is the lowest it's ever been, but still above what the unemployment rate is for white Americans. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that would seem to say, yes, progress has been made, but there still is that disparity.
Well, yeah, the disparities exist. We can look at it across multiple indices. You know, when you're looking at health disparities, the highest morbidity mortality rate, highest hypertension rate, highest type 1, type 2 diabetes rate. And so when the president mentioned that, the aggregate and the qualitative and quantitative data pointed to that, but it didn't happen solely because of him. A lot of these gains were made during the Obama administration, but we still have a wealth divide, and we still have poor whites, and that's what King was about as well. It wasn't just the unemployment rate that we kind of partial out and look at it, African Americans vis-a-vis whites, but King was also looking at this thing from a general context, where we have whites who are in, not even in South and North Dakota or the Appalachians or Mississippi or Georgia, but right here in urban areas in Pittsburgh and Harrisburg and Philadelphia, Chicago and Detroit, who are suffering as well. And so we have to also look at the context in which Trump shared that. Trump also, the back part of that was him saying that, you know, what do blacks have to lose? And so there's a fuller context than just the articulation of the unemployment rate is the lowest that has ever been.
Well, I think, yeah, and you're right, that bigger context. When the president, when he was campaigning, he was asking blacks to vote for him because what do they have to lose? What the point he was making is that African Americans traditionally have voted Democrat in the last 50 years or so, and that they haven't made, the group hasn't made a lot of progress during that time. I don't want to get too much into politics here, but does he have a point that way, that if African Americans, minorities, identify with one party and they haven't seen that much progress, are they being failed in that way?
Well, I think we need to look at the electoral system for all people. I think the two-party system is really, really not good for us. I think that there are, besides African Americans, I think that lots of groups don't have our interests at the heart of either party. You know, I campaigned on behalf of a candidate, Jess King, not because she was a Democrat, but because of her integrity and her values. So I think it's important for us as a community to not guarantee or be unconditional in our support of a party, but to be discerning and to make the entity that wants our support work for our vote or work for our participation.
And Dr. Kemp, you brought up campaigning for Jess King last fall, and
yes, she was running for Congress.
Right. You experienced what appears to be racism
mm-hmm.
firsthand. Tell us about that.
Well, I just wrote a hashtag canvassing while black to explain my experience. So I canvass in an area that is predominantly white. And as a black canvasser in a predominantly white area, I always went out with a little bit of fear of like, how would people receive me, a strange person coming up to their door wanting to talk with them about the issues that were important to them, which is what canvassing is. It is not soliciting. So... but for the most part, I found that when people did come to their doors, they were, you know, they were either polite or they were engaging. And that was just a nice experience for me, actually. I love canvassing. But on one unfortunate time, I went into a gated community with my white husband, and we were run out by a woman who chased us onto a street and, you know, took pictures of us and threatened to call police, which she did do. And the police showed up at my house. And I was shocked that the police would show up at my house because I was canvassing. And so I think what we know today is that people, the fear of blackness is deep, it is instinctual, and that, you know, folks have these automatic reactions of calling the police when they feel threatened, but the threat is really inside of them. It's not coming from me.
Did she make any overt racist comments? Or, I mean, was there a possibility that because you were in a gated community canvassing, mm-hmm. that that's why she called the police?
Yes, yes. Well, what we need to understand about racism is that it doesn't have, the N-word doesn't have to be said for there to be an intention to be exclusive. Also, the N-word doesn't have to be said for a brown or a black face to trigger a reaction of fear, hostility, anger. What we know is that with implicit bias is that people have these reactions instantly without a conscious thought. So I can't tell you what was inside her head, but I know that her actions, the degree to which she reacted to us and the degree to which the police actually sought us out and found us, came to our home to question us, to me was way over the line.
I want to ask both of you, we had you scheduled to appear for half the program today. We have so much more to talk about. Are you able to stay until 10 o'clock?
Yes.
Certainly.
Okay, let's do that. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're devoting the hour today to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. We're talking about race relations in America, a lot of other topics that we'll go on to the end of the program today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, our guest today, Dr. Amanda Kemp, visiting scholar of Africana Studies at Franklin and Marshall College. She's an author and racial justice and mindfulness mentor. Chad Dion Lassiter, executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission and a national race relations expert. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Lassiter, we were talking about the gap between black and white households. You both have touched on this. Racial disparities in the criminal justice system. There are percentage-wise, and I think even quantitative number-wise, more African-Americans in American prisons than there are European-Americans or whites. Why is that? Why is there a disparity?
Well, I think even before Michelle Alexander had her landmark book, The New Jim Crow, come out, we saw this data. I think one of the things that we have to do is have a frank conversation about the over-policing of black and brown bodies. We have to look at how prisons are on the private market, industrialized. We also have to look at the aspect of the prison industrial complex feeds aspects of communities that have limited to no resources. So if you look at various places in the Midwest, various places here in Pennsylvania. The economy may have been the industry around mining or steel. Well, when you don't have that and you're creating prisons, well, what you're doing is you're giving jobs to individuals in those communities who are not black and brown, and then the warehousing of black and brown bodies into the prison system with chattel slavery. We also understand the sentencing disparities where you're getting more time for certain offenses. We're quick to engage in this whole aspect of incarceration and not education. So we're looking at aspects of the school to prison pipeline, or what the Secretary of Corrections in the state of Pennsylvania, John Wetzel, calls the community to school to prison pipeline. And so this over-incarceration, this aspect of looking at people and demonizing them and not seeing their humanity, where some individuals may have been bipolar or schizophrenic, and that might have led to them going into the supermarket or the store and ended up robbing the store, and we're looking at incarcerating them when, in fact, they needed mental health. And so we recognize some of these aspects even in our schools. You're coming back from summer, and the first day of school, you're walking through a metal detector. A lot of young people, because I've done a lot of work in school, say, hey, listen, I just got back from Disneyland, and I just had a wonderful summer. Why am I going through a metal detector? And so we're looking at individuals as if we're providing an opportunity for them to get into the prison industrial system. We're also talking about public defenders who get the case at the last minute. We're also looking at the bail bonds and things of that nature, where some people are languishing in prison simply because they weren't able to post bail. And so mass incarceration is an issue. One of the things that we're seeing now is a bipartisan agreement of individuals coming together so that we have the Clean Slate bill that just came out. We also are creating new identities. We're doing more work around reentry in the prisons. Reentry doesn't start when individuals get out of prison. Reentry actually starts the moment you get in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually are going to be talking about Clean Slate on our program tomorrow. But I just want to go back to one thing you mentioned there, because you did list a whole lot of reasons that mm-hmm. this disparity occurs. But when you talk about the over-policing of black and brown neighborhoods, mm-hmm. there would be those who would say and would bring out statistics and say, well, that's where most of the crime is occurring, or there's a higher crime rate, or people in those neighborhoods are saying we need more police on the street to make it safer.
Yes, but we're looking for community policing. It's a different type of policing. If you look at the report that was created under Obama, where he brought together community leaders and police officials, the 21st Century Policing Commission, they recommended policing where police officers were known and trusted by community members, and where community members would feel a sense of that the police were there for them, not out to get them. And the problem is that the history of policing in poor urban or poor communities is that people feel like the police are there to keep us in, pin us in, make sure that we don't get out and disrupt the, you know, middle and upper middle class neighborhoods, rather than they're here to serve and protect us.
Mm. We're going to say, Mr. Lester.
I would say that all communities want to be protected. And so this notion that black and brown communities are creating a lot of violence, you know, the FBI reported just last year that 86% of whites commit crime. You know, so we never hear of this notion of white-on-white violence. People kill people that they live in close proximity to. So when you're looking at the news, you always hear black-on-black violence. That's a myth. Black people kill black people. White people kill white people. Asian-American Pacific Islanders kill Asian-American Pacific Islanders. And you also have Latino people who kill Latino people. What we have in our community is this whole historical aspect. Jill Nelson talks about this in her work of police brutality, where Dr. Kemp is so absolutely right that we're over-policing. And what we're doing is it's really a occupying terroristic force with paramilitary equipment. If you look at what happened in Ferguson, people were protesting. Martin Luther King, on this particular day, his words come to us in truth, where he verbalized that riots are the language of the unheard. So in Ferguson, it starts as a peaceful protest, but you have tanks and Black Hawks out there as if this was the Iraq war. So black and brown people want protection, but they want protection under the law. And so for us to look at some of the community policing tactics that have occurred, that's a beautiful thing. But what we also want our police officers to do is to see the humanity of black and brown people and not operate from a standpoint of white supremacy, racial and ethnic notions, or the implicit bias that oftentimes they do. When you're talking about the Amadou Diallo, who was a Senegalese who was just showing his ID and he got shot 41 times, like what happens in the mind of a police officer where you shoot someone 41 times?
But let me also bring up something here, because I've heard many people in law enforcement say this, that it's not like police officers wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go out and shoot a black person today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are, let's be real, there are some police officers who are, who shouldn't be there. Just like in almost any profession, there are people who are bad in that profession. But the work that the Human Relations Commission, I think, would be interested, the work that I'm interested in, is that proactive work, that recognition that to protect and serve people, you have to see the humanity and the individuality in the people who you're protecting and serving. And when you have policing with folks who come out from away from them, from other states or from the suburbs, and they're coming into a city, they don't have relationships per se. And relationships is actually where safety lies.
And I said earlier, and anyone who knows Dr. Amanda Kemp knows that she is multi-talented and works in the theater and with music and poetry. Here's a poem that Dr. Kemp put to music. Tell me a little bit about this.
It's called Make America Great, Not the Land of Hate Again. And okay. The music is by my husband, Michael, and our friend Francis Wong.
All right. Here's a snippet of Make America Great, Not the Land of Hate Again.
Make America Great, Not the Land of Hate Again. Make America great. Great like jazz. Great like hip hop. Great like powwow. Great like Chinese railroad workers. Great like no-no boys. And yes, 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 on the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Make America great. Not the land of hate again. Not the land of tarred Catholic priests and lynched Italian Americans. Make America great. Not the land of fake. Presidents who deny climate change, fracking brains, nothing sane, politicians who want to massacre.
We'll post the whole the video on our website, WITF.org. What did you want to say with that?
I wanted to say that, I have a positive vision and view of America. And it's a greatness that's built on our multicultural heritage, on the individuals and movements that give us great art, that give us great examples of individuals who are willing to share the pie rather than gobble it all up for themselves. So I mentioned lynched Italian Americans. You know, 11 Italian Americans were lynched in Louisiana. In part because at that time, Italians were not considered white. They weren't considered truly American. And so they were thought to be foreign and kind of dirty and dark. So I want to say, you know, let's make America great. Let's not go back to that past that others seem to think that we used to have.
It's impressive. I love the video. I mean, your husband, as you said, your husband plays on it.
Yes, he's a European American violinist, Juilliard trained, coming out of a Western tradition. But we met, and you know, and he's become a really good improviser, dabbling in the funk. It's awesome.
Let's go to Joe in Camp Hill. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. This is a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I wanted to advertise something, if I may, because the weather is so darn bad, and I'm thinking it might keep people home. Tonight, from 6 to 9 p.m., there'll be a two-hour discussion period, followed by a worship service. This is done in conjunction with many, many churches across the both sides of the river. The program is called One River, Two Shores. I'm sorry, One River, yes, One River, Two Shores. and it is to talk about the very, very same issues that you're talking about today. And during the worship service, there'll be a multi-church choir called Unity Choir singing, and it just promises to be a very worthwhile program, and I hope people will turn out. Yeah. It's going to be at 442 Hummel Avenue, Limoyne.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. The point she's making, and it's, I'm glad that people are doing that on this cold Martin Luther King Day, but she talked about the divide in the Susquehanna River. Here in the Harrisburg area, we hear that often, but you can point out multiple places in the state of Pennsylvania and across this country where there is a divide, sometimes a geographic divide, other times not a geographic divide. But here in central Pennsylvania, often talk about the Susquehanna River, the West Shore and the East Shore, and how there are so very few minorities on the West Shore, and that river being a divide. But the river is just one part of the divide. Dr. Kemp, what about that?
Well, I'm from New York originally. Actually, I came here from the Midwest because I've traveled around this country a lot. And the divides that I've seen have really, so like in our town of Lancaster City, for example, we have concentrations of poverty in one ward as opposed to all the other ones. And what I want to say to people is we need to look at creating structures that increase investment in those areas that can be marginalized because of the lack of economic resources. And I also want to say that it's important to reach out to those areas in a respectful way, to look for when those groups are having events, to go to those events. When they're having a parade, go to that parade, because that's, if they've advertised it to you, they want you to come. The problem with divides is that when we don't cross over, we don't really know those people. We don't build relationships. And our solution, our strength is going to come from relationships.
Mm-hmm. Chad Dion Lassiter, and by the way, we only have about 3 minutes left, so I have to ask you kind of, if you will, keep that in mind as we're having our discussion. And what we just talked about a little bit, we talked about divides, geographic, physical divides, and maybe not so physical divides. But that brings up a bigger point, is that in many places in this country, there is more segregated neighborhoods than, or as many, or as much as, say, the 1960s, the 1950s. Why, and what can be done about it?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to do is we have to come together to create the beloved community that Dr. King spoke about. I don't think I can sum it all up in such a short period of time. One of the things that we do know is that we have white flight. We also know that we have created racial enclaves where people are comfortable living where they live. We also understand that there is gentrification, or what Doug Massey calls American apartheid, the creation of these ghetto areas. One of the things I think that we have to really do is get beyond forms of xenophobia and get to know one another to make sure that we are seeing the humanity of one another. We understand that there's big development where there's a lot of spaces where investors are coming in. It's becoming college towns where people traditionally lived at. But for me, I just want us to make sure that we understand context. Context really matters. The divide is going to continue. Only way that we can actually make sure that we can break up the divide is that even if we go to those communities, like Dr. Kemp said, so even if a community is an all-white enclave, all Latino enclave, so forth and so on, how can we bridge that gap to work in those spaces with individuals and learn with each other? Not just, you know, cultural days where we're eating each other's food, but where we're listening, we're learning, and we're willing to participate and recognizing other people's humanity, their culture, learning from them with regards to their moral compass, their moral imperative, and things of that nature.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that, you know, the phrase, nothing with us without us, or nothing for us without us. So that speaks to really allowing or encouraging people in communities to their voices to matter, as opposed to experts coming in and telling them things.
Chad Dion Lassiter, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. He's an expert on race relations. Dr. Amanda Kemp, Visiting Scholar of Americana Studies at Franklin and Marshall and author, Racial Justice and Mindfulness Mentor. Thank you very much for being with us today. I hope everyone enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Coming
up, on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about clean slate and also what we had planned for today, talking about food safety as well. That's coming up on tomorrow's program.